This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Most of Oliver Stone's movies are collected on a new DVD box set. It comes in two editions, one with 6 films, the other with 10. Each edition includes extra scenes and Stone's commentary. His films include Platoon, Salvador, Born on the 4th of July, Wall Street, The Doors, JFK, Natural Born Killers, and Any Given Sunday. Platoon and Born on the 4th of July drew on his experiences in Vietnam. When Platoon was released in 1986, it was considered by many to be the film that best conveyed what it felt like to be a grunt in Vietnam. Although the film was enough to discourage anyone from fighting in a jungle war, writer and director Oliver Stone enlisted and asked to fight back in 1967. He won a Purple Heart. On this archive edition, we have a 1990 interview with Stone.
The main character in Platoon drops out of college, and his analytical reason that he gives one of the soldiers who thinks that, you know, he's crazy for being this middle class kid in the war. So the reason the Charlie Sheen character gives is, you know, why should only the poor people fight? What was your reason for enlisting?
Well, that was part of it. I felt a sense of that it was a wrong, the war was somehow wrongly fought. If only, if you could go to college to escape it, that if a war should be a democratic country, supposedly, therefore it should be fought along democratic principles. That means everybody goes, including senators' sons and the bankers' sons and I think that deeply bothered my sense of idealism about this country. And I did feel an obligation that I had to serve. I left Yale University, and there were other reasons, too. It wasn't just a sense of idealism. And there was a, personally, I did feel I wanted to see the war. I wanted to see war as a concept because I'd read about it in books and Hemingway and I have to admit, it had a romantic appeal to me, and I knew it was going to be the last war of my generation, and I wanted to be there. I wanted to be part of the passion and peril of our times, as Oliver Wendell Holmes said, you know.
How soon did it lose that romantic appeal?
First day in the bush, you know, I cut point, I think, in the 25th, they put up the new guys right up, like in the movie, and I think I lost that sense of, you know, it was pretty, it was clear to me in the first few days that the guys there were not really fighting for an objective or with any kind of morale. They were fighting just to count the days until they left. So everybody in the unit would have, I got 85 days to go, I got 165 days to go. You know, everybody would talk about the days left, which is not the right way to, you know, to really fight a war.
Your father was a stockbroker. You'd gone to prep school in Yale. Were your parents pleased that you had enlisted? Is that what they wanted for you?
No, they were horrified. Dad was a big believer in fighting communism, and until they took his own son, you know, he didn't. No, they thought I should stay in college. I was crazy to give that up.
Was there an element of rebellion against your parents,
of course,
in the act
of
enlisting?
That was probably the third part of the whole thing. Was that it was something that they didn't want me to do, therefore I had to do it. Because, to be honest, I'd had it with my parents, you know, I'd had it with that whole way of life. Something was wrong in the American system that as I had been educated to, and I think I was turning my back on the world as I knew it. I knew that it was, I didn't know what else there was, but I knew what I didn't want, which was to become some version of what my father was. Since then, I've grown to respect him enormously for what he's done and to see the things he went through and understand better, but at that time I was pretty angry.
Were you a physical person, and did you feel like that you could handle yourself well physically when you got to Vietnam?
I thought I could. Yeah, I was a good athlete, and I did learn ultimately. At first, I don't think anybody's a great soldier right off the bat. I mean, combat conditions are so intense and unplanned for that you never can tell what's going to happen. And I got shot the first time in a major, in my first night ambush, I got shot, and then I got shot a second time. After that, I got pretty smart in a bush, and I could move well without being hurt. I was carrying a lot of weight. I would carry 60, 70 pounds, or sometimes less. And, you know, but there was no question that the NVA, the North Vietnamese Army, were probably the best light infantry, you know, up to that time. I mean, there were great soldiers, too. And I'm not saying we were bad. I think that we did a good job, but we were up against people that we could travel very light, you know, eat rice, and didn't need hot baths or showers and didn't need hot food. You know, they lived close to the ground. We had too much. In Vietnam, we had too many support troops. It was 6 or 7 to 1. You know, we had too much rear echelon. It was, you know, I think the war, if assuming that it was going to be fought, and I don't think it should have, but it should have been fought more in a commando-style way, Israeli army kind of way.
Screenwriter and director Oliver Stone is my guest. This is a scene from his movie Platoon, which was based on his own experiences in Vietnam. Charlie Sheen plays a soldier who just arrived in Vietnam. This is a letter to his grandmother.
Somebody once wrote, "Hell is the impossibility of reason." That's what this place feels like, hell. I hate it already, and it's only been a week. The hardest thing I think I've ever done is go on point 3 times this week. I don't even know what I'm doing. A gook could be standing 3 feet in front of me and I wouldn't know it. I'm so tired. We get up at 5 a.m., hump all day, camp around 4 or 5, dig a foxhole, eat, then put out an all-night ambush or a 3-man listening post in the jungle. It's scary because nobody tells me how to do anything because I'm new. Nobody cares about the new guys. They don't even want to know your name. The unwritten rule is a new guy's life isn't worth as much because he hasn't put his time in yet. And they say if you're going to get killed in the Nam, it's better to get it in the first few weeks. The logic being, you don't suffer that much. If you're lucky, you get to stay in the perimeter at night. And then you pull a 3-hour guard shift. So maybe you sleep 3-4 hours a night, but you don't really sleep.
What was the feeling about being in a jungle war that you most wanted to communicate in Platoon?
Point of view, the subjectivity, the sense of fear and chaos, that you can understand what war really is, the confusion, the fact that maybe 20% of what happens in the people who get killed in a war get killed by their own friendly fire, the sense of fear and panic, and heroism too. There's daily acts of heroism. There's a bonding between the men. There was very much a split in Vietnam that I noticed. I was in 4 different platoons. I was in the 1st Cav and the 25th. And in all platoons, there was like a mini civil war going on. There was sort of the people that kind of believed in it, and the lifers, and then the people that, you know, were just draftees. There was the guys who smoked a little pot, and there were guys who drank too much. There was guys who liked Smokey Robinson. There was guys who liked country music. But there was generally a political split, you know. There was a certain element of racism, mm-hmm. very strong racism towards the Orientals from portions of the platoon, you know, that they were less than human. And a lot of the other guys were more tolerant and humanitarian. So I found that interesting. I kind of thought that it reflected, in some ways, the split I saw in the United States when I went back to the country.
The kind of confusion that you're talking about in the middle of a jungle war, you captured that both in Platoon and in Born on the 4th of July. Can you talk a little bit about choreographing a scene so that what you get watching it is the sense of confusion of not knowing, not being able to see, yeah. not knowing whose fire in the middle of or who you're firing at. But from your perspective as a director, everything has to be completely controlled to communicate that confusion.
Well, it's very important to show that confusion. Very important. You do not see the enemy very often. In fact, in the movies that I made, you see them a little too much uh-huh. because I always had to, you know, I have to compromise to some degree with the needs of an audience, but it's even more difficult to see them.
In real life, the tendency
in a movie is to bring somebody who's firing at you a little closer to camera so that you can at least see some outlines. In real life, it was probably more invisible and dirtier and even more surprising. And death is even worse than it is on the screen. I mean, death is so, you know, it's pretty ugly. And it smells bad, too. I got Dale Dye to work with me. He's an ex-Marine, and he was real helpful. You know, we'd walk the terrain, and, you basically plot it out, do your homework. But we kept it spontaneous. We had a terrific cameraman, Bob Richardson. We had some great Steadicam operating. We did Bourne. We did completely different than Platoon.
What were the differences?
I wanted to go with a beach. I wanted to go with a yellow, blinding because I worked up in the 1st Cav, up in the beach areas in the North 1st Corps. And I remember patrolling those beaches, and there were little dangers there that you don't get in the jungle. And the sense of the sun, it reminded me of Camus' Stranger, and that Kovic would lose it, you know, he would just lose it in the sun. And shoot his own man, you know, because he'd be blinded by the sunspots and sort of the panic, that crazy intent. You know, you don't, when the bullet flies, you're everything, the same, the human beings all respond the same. The eyes tighten, the brains kind of go dead a little bit. You don't think that much, you know, when you're under fire. So we tried to do Bourne real different than Platoon because people had seen a lot of the jungles. I think that's one of the things I'm real proud of in Bourne is the ocean and the beach and the village.
Is there any one story that you would always tell the actors who you worked with in those movies about what the war was like?
No, we put them through training. And
right.
It was important that they not sleep. I remember in Platoon, and we put them through 12 days with Dai up in the Philippine bush. And I really insisted. I said, I don't want this well-slept look that I see in war movies. I want these guys to look tired and beaten. And you can't fake that for some reason. You can't put makeup under their eyes. You got to give them a sense of what it's like not to sleep for a year. You don't sleep in Nam. You get three hours if you're lucky, and 2 hours here, but you're always sleeping with radar on. So that's where you get that kind of vacant look. So we put him in the bush, and we worked him around the clock. We made him, you know, pull guard duty and sentry duty all night, and they came out. They were so angry and irritable. That's the irritability of infantry all over the world at any time. It's a given. And I think we caught that, and the guys got it. But you can never teach an actor exactly what it's like, you know. But they are very imaginative actors, and they are able to cross that gulf and imagine. But there's no substitute for actually being there.
My guest is Oliver Stone. Most of his movies are collected in a new DVD box set. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1990 interview with screenwriter and director Oliver Stone. Let's listen to a scene from his 1987 movie, Wall Street. Here's Michael Douglas as a ruthless arbitrager persuading a room full of stockholders to overthrow the company management.
I am not a destroyer of companies. I am a liberator of them.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind, and greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. Thank you very much.
Let me ask you about the film Wall Street. Your father was or is a stockbroker.
Was a stockbroker.
Yes. Where would he have fit into that movie, if at all?
Dad would probably be a combination of Marty Sheen and Hal Holbrook. You know, he was the older broker, doing things a bit the old-fashioned way, and also a lot of the scenes between Marty and Charlie were kind of like scenes I'd based on my own relationship with Dad.
Did he want you to go into the business ever?
Oh, when I was young, yeah, before college. Yeah, he thought it would be a good way to make a living, you know. And but it was never, I never was any good at that. My mathematics were pretty dreadful. And I did terribly in economics, that's right. At freshman in college, I got a D or a C in economics. I just couldn't understand economics. It's very dismal.
But
he was good at it.
But I guess all that background helped you for the movie.
The mood of the movie, yeah. I found it very confusing, but I tried to clarify. I think I did a pretty good job of... Stanley Weiser, of course, helped me. He was my co-writer. But I think we clarified the a very difficult situation. We tried to make it clear, you know, the actual mechanics of what goes on and how buyouts are made, how you can make money off stock. But Dad wouldn't recognize the new Wall Street. They're moving huge amounts of volume. It's just jumped. I mean, it's really a computerized business now. In the old days, he was a customer's man. You know, you dealt with an individual group of clients. You took care of them over time. It was a relationship, like a banker with a small town or something like that. And he was also an economist. He wrote wonderful letters about economics for a monthly investment letter, which was very well respected in the 50s, 60s internationally. He considered himself really more of a writer than a really great businessman. But he would not recognize that Wall Street. The whole concept of making that money would elude him.
We're listening to an interview with Oliver Stone. When I spoke with him in 1990, he was in the process of wrapping up production on his film about the Doors.
It's going to be a big editing job. It's about 25 songs. It's a huge movie, 500,000 feet. I think it's going to take a lot of special effects, actually. We did
Are these tripping special effects?
Tripping special effects. Right. And yeah, we're trying to play with colors and perception, the concept of psychological perception, how that changes, not just with tripping, but with life itself, the way things darken and lighten and shift in your consciousness. So it's a film very much about expansion of consciousness. Jim was always after that. He was always trying to get through the barriers, trying to break through the limits of life.
Now, what did Jim Morrison mean to you?
Well, pretty much that, that he was for a PR phrase, I'd say, an avatar of consciousness, somebody who was, the theme of his life would be break on through to the other side, which is his anthem song, He pushed things sexually, chemically, philosophically, poetry. I think success for him itself was a limitation. I think that the ultimate trip for him, I mean, I used a 60s word, the ultimate limitation, the last place to go, the last frontier for him was death. And I think that, if you look at the poetry and the songs, death is mentioned frequently. He was half in love with death, as were the great romantic poets of the 19th century. And I think that was one of his visiting spots, one of his destinations.
What phase of your life are the Doors records associated with? Is it Vietnam? Is it being home afterwards?
I'd say a combination of 67, definitely 60s, late 67 in Vietnam, turning on to it with black guys, listening to it and smoking marijuana, taking acid, and R&R trips down to Australia then going over to back to the States. And there was a run there, about 68, 69, they were very much, I was big fans of Jim and the Doors. And then, they were never that popular, actually, in the States. I never found them to be huge the way they were but they've stayed in the consciousness, and in some ways they've become more popular after Jim's death. I speak to a lot of 17, 18-year-olds that have heard the music and are very much with it.
What are you doing for a period feel in the film?
Oh, we hit all the bases we have to, it's amazing in 20 years what happens. I mean, I thought it would be relatively simple to shoot, but everything was a pain in the ass. I mean, every street you take over, mailboxes, cars, the clothing, the makeup on the women, for example. I was going crazy waiting for the women extras to come out, and they'd say, well, they got to put more makeup on. And then I'd cast these beautiful young women, and they'd go into makeup, and they'd come out looking horrible. And I said, something's wrong here. It's like, they said, no, this is the way the women were. They were very made up and a little bit overdressed. I mean, I don't think the styles were particularly flattering. But as I remember, they were breakthrough styles back then. They were colorful people. People never had dressed that way. It was a great moment in the film. We were in San Francisco shooting Haight-Ashbury. And we set up one whole sidewalk. Signage, all the streets had to be changed, the shops. And we had 500 extras in wonderful yellows and reds and blues walking down the street, and all hippies and stuff. And I looked across the street on the other side, and there were all the tourists that come and were looking. And they were all gray and black and dark in clothing. And I said, I should take my camera now, like a Godard movie, and you pan from all the hippies in the 60s. You swing across the street for about two beats, and you see like the 90s looking at the 60s, and then you go back across the street to the 60s. That would have been a great moment in the movie. I never did it, though.
Is there a character in the film who's your surrogate?
My surrogate? No. Who would that be? You
mean, I don't know. The Oliver Stone character.
Jim. Yeah. The character... I identified with him in a lot of ways. I would have liked to have led that kind of life where you're breaking on through and testing things all the time. I do in my own way. I respect him as a writer, and I think he wanted to be a director of films when if he had lived. He always talked about going back to filmmaking. He was a UCLA film student before he became a rock musician.
Oliver Stone recorded in 1990. A new DVD box set collects most of his movies. It comes in two editions, one with 6 films, one with 10. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.